So I made staff meal at work yesterday for the first time in like quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really, we try to make staff meal for everybody like on a regular basis when there's staff around.
Right.
But in the winter, there's just a lot fewer people. And so it doesn't really make sense
mm-hmm.
to have like family meal where we all sit down.
Mm-hmm.
But we have quite a few people back in the kitchen now, and they're specifically on Wednesdays, we have like a full complement. So
mm-hmm.
we're starting up the staff meal program again.
So what'd you make?
Yeah. So I made currywurst.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah. Which was awesome. But I was like, well, this is kind of silly, but I was really sad that I couldn't get like really good brats for it.
What do you mean you can't get really good brats?
Well, it's my own problem that I couldn't get really good brats, but I did try to go to K&K
mm-hmm.
to get brats, but they're closed on the day that I was shopping. Like, I think they're closed on Mondays and Sundays or something. I don't know.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah. So I went there and they were closed. And so I just had to buy brats in a grocery store, and
mm-hmm.
they weren't as good as I was hoping for.
Right.
And I was really missing Zalt.
Yeah. So you had like what, Johnsonville brats kind of thing
sort of and they curry were ketchup? They were fryby. Actually, they weren't terrible. Like, the texture was pretty close, but like the size of the grind was not correct for what you'd expect from bratwurst, but mm-hmm. or from for currywurst, but
mm-hmm. And you made curry ketchup, okay. And french fries or what?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
the curry ketchup was really good, and I made french fries. So I don't know. I have this like thing bumping around in my head, and I can't quite like wrap my head around it, but I was looking for a good French fry recipe, one that I hadn't really tried before. I've made several versions of French fries historically, mm-hmm. but I wanted something that would be manageable to do, like where I would still get a good result, but I could do it like in a pot on an induction burner,
mm-hmm.
Which turns out, man, even like the fairly powerful induction burners that we have at work mm-hmm. don't really output enough heat to keep oil hot enough to do deep frying in any kind of like,
oh really,
yeah, quick fashion, like mm-hmm. just putting like it maybe like a half a pound of fries in just like reduces the heat so much, and it takes so long for it to catch back up that mm-hmm. it was like a pretty long drawn out process to make enough fries for like 12 people.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Like, I have this, like, maybe you can help me formulate this into an actual thought, Alan, but like, so I was looking around for French fry recipes, and the one that I found that looked like foolproof was Heston Blumenthal's French fry recipe,
like, which, to be fair,
what's that?
The triple cooked one?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Which, to be fair, is a little more complicated than you would really normally want.
Yes.
You know, if you're not picking up each fry and salting it individually and putting it on someone's plate, which, you know, if you are doing that, then it's worth putting in the extra time. But
right.
But yeah, it's like a triple blanch method. So you blanch them in water first, and then you rough up the outside, so the outsides are going to get nice and crispy, and then they're already really cooked inside. So by the time you blanch them in oil and then fry them again, they're like so crispy on the outside, but the inside is just like mashed potato.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked out pretty well, but I don't know. I was just thinking about how, like, you know, that technique, I mean, although it's, you know, it's not really breaking new ground necessarily. Like, people have been blanching and making French fries for probably 100 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
But like the idea that like, because like techniques that came out of modernist cooking feel kind of contemporary or feel new still, mm-hmm. but it's weird because a lot of them, well, you know, plenty of them are built on old techniques, and those old techniques are still totally valid. And right. It's just, I feel like it's kind of funny because we're starting to get a little bit of distance between like the trend of modernist cooking mm-hmm. and starting to, I think, see like which techniques are shaking out to be actually useful in like, you know,
yes,
in everyday use and, you know, and in like delivering an amazing product. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I don't think that every restaurant is going to start triple blanching their fries, but like when I was like looking for recipes on the internet, I found tons of places that are doing that.
Yes.
And that's kind of how we were doing it. I think at Fiskabar too, we were doing a blanch in water the day before and then refrigerating. I don't think we were freezing them. And then blanching them in oil twice on the day. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like this technique that seems like way out there in a way, or like seems like a lot of extra work, but it's kind of worth it because you get this like amazing result. And I don't know, I just think it's interesting how, I don't know, those techniques, like some modernist techniques are starting to feel like just accepted or just like, this is just a part of the toolbox. This is just,
yes.
Now this is an old technique or something like that.
Right.
And like the line of differentiation between like, you know, what might be considered a modern way of doing something and what might be considered like a old way, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
Is sort of starting to get blurred. And I find that interesting.
Maybe I need to have your triple cooked fries, but my take on it has been, because whenever I think that there must have been a, In Search of Perfection episode or something where Heston really brought that concept to the masses. And then in gastropubs and bars all over the place, all of a sudden on the menu, it says triple cooked fries.
Right.
And to me, it was always like, when you put that on the menu, I'm like, okay, fine. They better be the best French fries I've ever had because you're saying they're triple cooked and you're marketing it that way. And
well, and like for some reason, like you watch a video where Heston triple cooks his fries and it looks like he gets a good result. Mm-hmm. But why does calling them triple cooked on the menu convey anything about the quality of the fry to the customer? Nobody knows. Most people don't know that fries are cooked twice.
Yes, that's right.
So
for example, Peter's Drive-In doesn't know that fries are cooked twice. I'm just sick French fry burn.
Harsh.
Really, really the worst French fries in the city, in the province, I mean. But yeah, to me, it was always a case of, I'm sure there's, you can do the technique well or you can do it poorly, but like putting it on the menu was always like an over-promise, under-deliver kind of situation for me. Mm-hmm. Almost like putting, I feel the same way about putting something like sous vide on the menu. Like,
right, yeah.
Sous vide.
Yeah, I agree.
Roast, or like sous vide beef on a sandwich. And it's like,
like that's not telling the customer anything.
Yeah, why don't you just, you know, cook it sous vide and then make sure that it's seasoned well and the customer will be blown away by how uniformly medium rare it all is or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever
or the how case tender is. It is. Just call it tender beef, you know, or something that might mean something to the customer, mm-hmm. but you know, like sous vide doesn't mean anything to the customer. Well, to a very specific customer maybe, but like not mm-hmm. to most people.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sudeby, and I'm here with my co-host, Shale McDonald. Hi, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. So what other techniques have shaken out? What are so-called modernist techniques that are now just part of the kit?
Well, I do think sous vide has shaken out.
Yep.
Like it's much, you know, much, it's in much more common use, even in, you know, not just like fine dining restaurants.
Yes.
I'm kind of like the wrong person to talk to about that because I sort of bring it with me as like the ultimate piece of kit in my toolbox wherever I go and work. So I'm kind of like overly exposed to it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do see it around it. And it seems less when I like interview new cooks or, you know, show cooks that I'm training the technique that we're using, a lot more cooks seem a lot more familiar with it now than I think did like 10 years ago.
Right. You know what is funny about cooking sous vide and training? Like I find that a lot of cooks who haven't been properly trained on it kind of just treat it as like a magical solution to all the problems, and they don't really, they stop in a way, they turn off part of their brain when they're using it. right. and don't use common sense things like, is the food coming out of this bath cooked? Is it hot? Is it, do you know what I mean?
Like, right. They just put it in, and if the expectation is that it's going to come out in the same condition every time, they're not being analytical about whether the conditions in the bath are, you know, are yeah. correct or,
yeah. Yeah. Or like, in a really simple example, like if we're holding a braised item on the line during service in a circulator bath and we sell all of the portions that are in the bath, and so we have to put fresh cold portions from the fridge in the bath, and then they serve they try and serve them 10 minutes later.
And it's like, well, it's not, it's just hot. Like immediately hot. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, and it's, it comes down
that's
to
what the
training.
Microwave is for, Alan. Well, that's yeah, the magic it. Hot maker.
But it is a matter of training. They just haven't yeah. been like, they need that rule of thumb. Like, it's an hour per inch of thickness to get to temp or whatever it is. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. It's there are a lot of, it is a complicated way to cook. It can reduce that. It can reduce the amount of complication in terms of getting the product that you want, mm-hmm. but you need to understand all of the variables in order for it to work correctly. And mm-hmm. there are some kind of non-intuitive variables in a way. Mm-hmm.
For me, xanthan in oh, purees yeah. is now like de rigueur. Like, just like
yeah.
if we're making any kind of like not necessarily vinaigrettes and stuff like that, but like purees, like smooth pesto type herb purees, mm-hmm. smooth like soubise kind of purees. Yeah, all of my recipes now have like finished with xanthan, just to, so you don't get any of the like leaching on the edges when it's plated and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there are like also modified cornstarch is sort of,
oh yeah.
It was in wide use.
Is that
more
different
like,
than is that different than cornstarch?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, the granules are pre-gelatinized.
Oh, okay. And oh, like so, ultrasperse.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay,
yeah, like ultrasperse. Yeah, that's modified cornstarch.
I see.
Yeah, and basically what it does is it makes it so that it doesn't clump in most liquids at most temperatures, mm-hmm. and that also after it has been incorporated into the liquid, you can freeze it and thaw it and warm it and cool it, and it maintains its consistency, whereas with regular cornstarch, that's not necessarily the case.
That's so I can't believe you just brought that up. I've been I can't believe that I didn't look into it earlier, but it's something that I've been thinking about at work. We have a couple menu items where we're like, say for a braise, where we're saucing the meat with a Joulier, so like the braising liquid just thickened with cornstarch. Yeah. I've just been noticing how it's not very thermo. I think maybe technically it's thermo reversible, but when you thicken the jus with the cornstarch, chill it, and then heat it, it's not quite the same consistency. It's a little bit clumpy and a little bit almost like, it's got a weird, the texture changes. It's almost slimier or something.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I've found like when you reheat after cooling things with cornstarch that sometimes it's just like that, the starchy, like the thickening just goes away completely. Hmm. But I don't exactly know what the conditions are that cause that. But yeah, that's mm-hmm. definitely a thing too, where like cornstarch will just like lose its thickening power through some thermal regimes. Mm-hmm.
It's weird. Like, I don't know if I'm describing it quite, I don't know if I'm describing it well enough, but like, it's almost like I'll be testing a Joulier that has been cooled and reheated and it looks clumpy. And so like I'm like, okay, this needs to go through a chinois or this needs to be
right.
hit with a stick blender to smooth it out. But we do those things and it still has this kind of odd texture. It's not like clumps,
that's interesting.
Like solid clumps.
Yeah,
it.
No, it's like, more like the liquid is not shearing correctly.
Yeah.
Or
it almost has like a kind of jello vibe to it somehow.
Yeah.
Like,
I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Huh.
So yeah, I'm interested. I wonder, I bet the patisserie has modified cornstarch and I could see if that works better.
I'd definitely give it a shot. Hmm. It's much better for, yeah, especially like for being thermally stable.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Cool.
But yeah, that's one I think, you know, it used to be widely used in commercial applications because it's just much easier to apply. Like mm-hmm. you can put it into hot liquid and it won't clump and stuff like that. Right. And so it was like pretty widely used for a lot of like, you know, canned soups and things like that. I think generally have some modified cornstarch in them and mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But I think, yeah, it's in much broader use in like smaller kitchens now than it was. Mm-hmm. People are less afraid of it. I think, you know, I remember when I started my early career, it was sort of like a, I don't know, it was like looked down upon or something. Like it was like a, cheat. I don't know.
A hack move.
Yeah, it was a hack. Yeah, it was a hack move or something.
Yeah, but. Like using a microwave.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. I had, I can't remember if I've told you this, but something really embarrassing. Speaking of modernist pantry and like learning about that, super embarrassing. When I guess when I started at Nate, I, for most of my career, I had been like kind of reactionary and opposed to a lot of quote unquote modernist things. You uh-huh. helped me a lot in that regard, especially with sous vide.
Thanks, Alan.
But I still, when I started at Nate, I hadn't worked with agar. I hadn't really worked with xanthan. I didn't really understand them very well, but I made mm-hmm. a point because, you know, like as an instructor, you want to be well-rounded and be able to answer questions. And all of a sudden, these ingredients and pieces of equipment in the teaching kitchens that I just felt like I needed to be familiar with. And so I set out specifically to figure out agar, make fluid gels, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I found this. It wasn't like a proper retail container of agar. It was a deli cup with a piece of tape on it that said agar. And so
you didn't know who put that tape there?
No, there was no date, no initial, no, it just said agar. So I start working with it and I'm like watching videos online, reading recipes, and I probably do 5 different attempts with this. And I'm like,
oh my God.
I don't know how, like, I'm messing this up. I would add, like,
this is heartbreaking.
I would add the quote unquote agar and it would just start clumping. And I was like, how do you disperse this properly? Like, it's just like making this sticky mess. And then when I chilled it down, it didn't set hard. Like, it was supposed to be like a very hard set, but it was still like goopy. And I was like, what is going on? And I eventually found out that it was not agar in the deli cup. It was xanthan gum. And so I was adding like these enormous quantities of xanthan gum to like fruit juices and stuff and just making these horrible slimy sticky messes.
Horrible slimes that crawled away.
Yeah, exactly. They were really revolting. Oh, they had such a weird texture.
That is heartbreaking.
But what's really embarrassing is how many times I did it before I like
before
finally
you were
like
maybe this isn't the right product.
Yeah. Yeah.
It reminds me of the time when I was in the apprenticeship competition with my friend Jordan in mm-hmm. in BC at VCC and his final dish and his cook had gone really well and his dessert was a creme brulee,
right?
And he tricked himself by putting salt into his sugar and he stood there for like 15 minutes trying to brulee salt on top of his creme brulee.
Yeah.
And it just was not working and he was like, what is happening?
It's the that quote that I love, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing multiple
same
times
thing
and expecting different results. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a little piece of follow-up, Alan.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know if it's a bone to pick or if I'm... No, yeah, if it's a bone to pick, it's a bone to pick with myself, I guess. But
okay.
When we went to Steel Wheels, somehow, I don't know, I think I was just like swept away with... with your traditional way of interacting with the food there and wanting to like wanting you to guide me through my first Steel Wheels experience, but I don't think I had a super good look at the menu. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, but I thought that I did look at the menu while I was in there, but maybe I just was looking at the soup parts because you were talking about the soups or something. I don't know. I'm not very good at looking at menus and assessing everything that's on them a lot of the time. Like I get stuck on things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that is. But anyway, I was just like checking to see if I could maybe order from Steel Wheels on like Skip the Dishes or Uber Eats or something like that. And so I was looking at their menu on the apps.
Right.
And apparently they have a spicy squid dish.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And like squid is like my jam.
Yeah.
That's like one of my favorite foods. I order squid everywhere, every time I see it. And I was like really sad that we didn't get it.
Mm-hmm. Is it a stew or just like a pan fry?
I think
situation?
It's like a stir fry. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I've never had it.
Like, well, I'm definitely going to try it.
I also don't know if I knew about your, I mean.
Oh, really?
I wouldn't have doubted that you like a good squid, but I didn't know it was a
man
disgusting obsession of yours.
Yeah, I'm kind of obsessed, honestly.
Yeah. Okay. Next time.
Yeah, squid and octopus, but like really squid. Like calamari, I think, is one of my very, very favorite things. Even bad calamari, I'll eat it.
Really?
Like, yeah. Hmm. I don't know what it is. I think because you don't, because not every place has it or something. I feel like the scarcity of it on menus kind of like plays into the reason why I like it so much.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, I think the texture of the meat and the flavors that you get when you salt it properly and stuff are just like really satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's kind of like my thing.
I had octopus for supper last night.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you prepare it?
Well, it was actually, we recently had a chef in residence program at Nate.
Mm-hmm.
And Connie D'Souza and John Jackson from Char Cut and Char Bar in Calgary were there.
Right.
And we made a dish for one of the dinner services with them that was octopus, like steamed octopus in like tomato-y sauce with linguiça, like Portuguese sausage.
Damn.
And broad beans. And we had some of that left over. And so in class yesterday, we cooked spaghetti and had octopus tomato sauce with it.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It sounds amazing, Alan. I feel like at some point maybe we should have a conversation about the chef in residence program. I'm really curious about how that works. And
yeah. Yeah. There's been some really, really great chefs go through Nate over the last, they've done it for like, I think it started around 2008. And then a couple years during the pandemic, they didn't do it, but that means they've had like 12 or so chefs go through there. Some really, really cool people.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And actually, and speaking of, you talk about me shepherding you through your Steel Wheels experience. Mm-hmm. I was kind of guided through a very interesting food experience last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do you know what balut is?
I do know what balut is.
So for those of
you, it's like the kind of thing that you would have to put a towel over your head to consume, but not quite exactly.
For folks who don't know balut, so B-A-L-U-T, I think. D-T?
T? Yeah, you're right. T.
It is a duck egg that has a fetal duck inside that is steamed or boiled and then eaten out of the shell. Right. And I first heard about them actually when I was in culinary school. I remember my garde manger instructor, I think he had been traveling maybe in China, and he told us about this experience of eating it. And I think for a lot of North Americans, there's like a gut reaction, like most people find the idea pretty repulsive.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I find it repulsive personally. Mm-hmm. But I definitely have some kind of, I have never tried one.
Mm.
And I would love to try one because I really love trying new things. And most foods that I try, I enjoy. Even if they're things that a lot of people say, oh, this is an acquired taste or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like usually, you know, the first time I try them, I can sort of see what's appealing about them.
Right.
But I have to say, like, if I'm being perfectly honest, that balut is like one of the things that I'm worried to try that I would like, that I would wind up finding it like unappetizing or something like that.
Yeah. It, like when that instructor first described it to me, like he was talking about the, like the textures people would probably find challenging because there's, yes, there's the egg, but then like the fetal duck, like there's kind of like cartilaginous crunch to it and stuff like that.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think this, the dish maybe originated in South China, but today I think is most popular and most associated with the Philippines. Okay. And the last group of students I had, several of them were Filipino, and they were just talking about it one day. And a couple of them, like, it's one of their favorite, it's like a street food basically, cause you can eat it out of the shell and walk while you're walking around. For a couple of them, it's like a favorite snack. And so they decided that they were going to bring some in and have me try it. And
do you know where they got it?
It was, I believe, through an online vendor.
Oh, okay.
I don't know very much about how it was procured, though.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
They're not just keeping ducks in their yard?
No. No, I think they said online. Maybe I'm just not aware. I don't think I've seen it in markets in Edmonton.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they said they were going to bring one in. I had a few days to stew on it. And I do think that my gut reaction is like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to enjoy that.
Right.
But I just rationalized the heck out of it and was like, I eat eggs. I eat ducks.
Thousands of people eat this every day.
Yeah. I'm not usually concerned about the age of the, if I'm eating meat, about the age of the animal I eat veal and all that stuff. So anyways, and then, they brought them in and they, simmered them and showed me how to eat it. And basically you crack, I think the narrower pointed end of the egg, you crack that, and peel back the shell. And first there's actually, like, even after it's hard cooked, there's some liquid inside, like a kind of broth. So once you've taken off the top, you can add a little bit of salt, and if you want a little bit of vinegar, and you drink that liquid, and it tastes like broth. Like, it tastes like poultry broth. It doesn't have the mouthfeel, like, it doesn't have any gelatin in it, so it doesn't have the mouthfeel of like a good chicken stock, but that's what it tastes like effectively. Like, it's like soup.
Do you know how long they simmered it for?
It was long. It was longer than for a hard cooked egg. Like, it was, I would say it was more than 20 minutes, but I'm not 100% sure.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So after that sip, take more of the shell off, and then, there's a hard cooked yolk. And so the next bite is just a hard cooked egg, and you can dip it in salt, and it doesn't taste any different than a normal, hard cooked egg yolk. But then you get to the little duck. Apparently I got off easy. One interesting thing about the way that these are sold is, like, they sell them by the number of days that it's been incubated.
Right.
And I can't remember the numbers, but I think, like, you can get an 11 day one, a 16 day one, a 21 day one, or whatever. And obviously the duck is going to be more developed the older it is, and you'll have more of those, the crunchier, like, cartilage textures bones and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, and also, like, the yolk, I would imagine, would be smaller, right? Because the yolk is like the nutrient source for the growing embryo inside the egg. Yeah. And so I'm assuming that as the embryo grows, the yolk gets smaller.
That makes sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So apparently I got off easy and had a, like, all of the eggs that they brought in were of this, like, graded at the same incubation time, but mine apparently was especially younger, or less developed. And so that bite, like, honestly, like most things, most new food experiences, or like what you might consider exotic protein and stuff, it was not half as weird as you might think, or as it had been built up in my mind. There was the textures were not half as challenging as, like, other cartilage things like pig's ear and stuff like that. It definitely had like a meaty, like, flaked braised meat texture to it, the bulk of it. And it tasted like duck. It tasted like egg and duck. It was really not not as strange as I expected it to
was
be.
Expecting.
Yeah.
What about feathers?
Well, that was another thing. So I could see the beginning of feathers developing. And I did have like one piece in my mouth that like I couldn't chew through. It's very small though. And so, yeah, that would be much more pronounced in the older specimens. Right. But
Online. Hey, I'm really curious. Maybe I can go online and find some and try it out.
Yeah. See.
Yeah.
And there is like the part of the white, and I don't know if it's because of how long it is cooked or if that's just what the white is like at that stage of development. The white is very hard and rubbery.
Oh, interesting.
You can chew it, but apparently like a lot of people don't bother with it and they'll just throw it away. But,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh. Like how hard and rubbery?
Well, like I said, you can bite through it. Like I did try it just for curiosity's sake.
Because I do feel like like under normal circumstances, unfertilized duck eggs have a slightly kind of like, I don't want to say harder, but like, you know, a slightly denser white maybe when it's cooked. Mm-hmm. But
this was like markedly, like it was like chewing a piece of rubber.
That's interesting.
Anyways, it was a cool experience and I was really glad, like happy that the students shared it with me and walked me through it. And yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. First try food experiences that are like of things that you've heard of for a long time, but you think might be challenging or something like that are so precious to me now after having tried so much food. And like, you know, it's like I rarely get to try something that I have never tried before or that I haven't heard of, or you know, like that's awesome. I would like to try that, man. And it's funny too because like I don't know, like is there a thing where when you have more experiences like that it's less, it becomes less challenging, even if maybe under normal circumstances it would be challenging or something. I don't know. Like, okay, this is kind of a dumb story and it's probably going to be long and it's definitely a tangent, but you're hearing about your experience just really reminded me of it. And, and I don't know, I found it really interesting, but like, I'm going to be going to Japan for a month in May.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, which is very exciting. Probably going to have to record an episode while I'm in Japan, and that's going to be crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been watching a ton of like YouTube videos about Japan and Japan food and a lot of the other things that I'm really excited to check out while I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
A friend told me that there's like a travelogue show with Paul Hollywood going to Japan and trying all of the foods.
Who's Paul Hollywood?
I'm a little surprised that you don't know, Alan. But Paul Hollywood is one of the original hosts of the Great British Bake Off.
Okay.
Okay.
Was he famous before that or?
I mean, probably, or maybe in Britain or something. I don't know too much about him. And to be honest with you, I'm not really a fan of his. Like, okay. I kind of find his, I don't know, his like way of communicating and his attitude a little bit like grating. And not really a fan. But
is the Great British Bake Off a show that I should have watched, or that I should watch? I mean, is it?
I mean, it depends. I've seen a few episodes, but I can't really watch reality cooking shows.
Right.
Like, not that they like give me anxiety or something, but I don't enjoy watching. I don't know. There's a lot of different styles of cooking shows, but like, I feel like an overarching theme for like cooking reality shows is like showing people like who maybe don't really have a solid idea of what they're supposed to be doing, bumbling through something and making mistakes, and then for someone to judge them on their mistake making, like, right. I don't enjoy it.
Yeah,
for whatever reason. No shade if you're addicted to the Great British Bake Off or Top Chef or whatever. I used to watch tons of those shows, but I just got bored of them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that they give me anxiety or that, you know, like, I feel bad. I just, it's not fun for me to watch. I'm just like, yeah, yes. Okay. Like, yeah. But anyway.
So sorry, Paul Hollywood.
That was a tangent within the tangent.
Yeah, it was a sub-tangent.
And now we're coming back to the main tangent before we get back to the actual episode that we're going to record.
Are you familiar with tangent stacking?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, stacking and code writing? It's like that.
Yeah, I do know stacking and code writing. Okay, and then I also know do you know the expression popping the stack?
No, is that related to
where
the
you instantly come back to the main thread? Yeah, oh, okay, that's something I'm not capable of.
Yeah, clearly. Paul Hollywood is in Japan eating food.
So yeah, I my sister and I decided to watch this Paul Hollywood in Japan show. Mm-hmm. And in one of the episodes, he goes to Kyoto where there's like a very specific type of dining called kaiseki. Mm-hmm. Or kaiseki. Mm-hmm. Can't remember. But it's like a traditional form of dining that I believe originated in Kyoto, because in Kyoto is like sort of where they kind of show it off the most. Mm-hmm. Paul Hollywood's there to try the food. He goes for this kaiseki meal in Kyoto, and it's at a 3-Michelin-star kaiseki restaurant. Mm-hmm. And he's suitably excited for it.
Right.
But he sits down to eat it, and the first 3 or 4 courses are sushi and sashimi,
right?
Which is like, seems perfectly normal to me and seems like exactly what you would expect. Mm-hmm. But apparently Paul Hollywood has never really eaten raw fish before.
Oh, really?
And it was like extremely challenging for him. And he was like, you know, just really having a problem with the texture of the fish and stuff like that.
Okay.
And yeah, it was just like shocking to me, because he's like, I mean, you know, mostly he's just doing baking, and mostly he's baking only British things.
Right.
The other theme of the show is like, you can't look at any type of Japanese food, even if it's like perfectly analogous to food that's available everywhere else in the world, you can't look at a single piece of Japanese food without somehow comparing it directly to something that British people are perfectly aware right. of, you know,
like, I see ya.
Which is extremely annoying to me, but but like he's obviously has a lot of exposure to food, probably mostly baking, but the idea that, like, you know, like whenever they filmed the show sometime in the last like 5 years, I'm assuming, mm-hmm. That like he would not have exposure to eating raw fish, it just seems right. so shocking to me.
Like someone whose, like, job is in food media.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, like, and he's trying sushi for the first time in a 3-Michelin-star kaiseki right. restaurant, and he's like, oh my God, I'm going to have to eat this tuna. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. It's like, and then also, I don't know, I guess maybe I just have, you know, from my own experience, I have a higher expectation of people who are involved in food, you know, like that, you know, they would have a more open mind about trying something like that, or would be right. excited to try something new yeah. like that.
And
but he seemed extremely apprehensive. Huh. And yeah, I don't know. It's just a little shocking to me. I felt bad for him, you know, like I felt bad that he didn't get to enjoy the experience of trying something new in that way and like feel mm-hmm. good coming away from it. You know, like he definitely like he tried everything, but he said himself that it was very challenging for him to do. So, mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting. I mean, I don't know if it's, do you think it's quite different in the UK? Like, is there not?
I definitely think that. I think that there probably is less Japanese food maybe available, or it's, you know, not quite as common maybe as mm-hmm. it is in North America or something like that. But yeah, I don't know. It still seemed weird to me.
I do think, like, the food, our food culture has changed a lot more than we usually recognize, like even just over the course of our lifetime. Like definitely when I was 10 years old, sushi was basically the butt of a joke. It was like raw fish. Right. Are you serious?
Yeah.
And that was partly because I was 10, partly because of where I lived. It wasn't like a very diverse place. There probably wasn't sushi restaurants in Brights Grove, Ontario in 1995.
I don't know, Alan.
Well, anyways. Yeah,
maybe so, not in Brights Grove.
Like I'm sure there was in Vancouver, but there might not have been in rural Ontario.
Yeah, that's fair.
So yeah, it's hard for me to tell because so much time has passed and now I live in a bigger city and a much more diverse place. But like, I think that food culture has changed in a big way. And like, yeah, raw fish is very much a much more normal, even for people who didn't grow up eating it now. So
yeah. Anyways, now it's time to pop the stack.
Okay.
We actually have a topic that we were going to talk about.
Yeah, sort of. No, I'm just kidding. We do. We're going to talk a little bit about menu planning because I'm in some preparatory courses to get my chef de cuisine certification. And the course I'm in right now is just called menu planning. And I've been doing the readings, doing the assignments, and a lot of it was reminding me of our conversation about recipe development and product development. And I wanted to share some of the course material with you, get your take, and yeah, just discuss it because I think it's interesting.
Cool. And so is the course material from a book, or is it sort of like handouts that are provided by the person that's putting the course together for you, or?
Both. There is a textbook. It's called Foundations of Menu Planning by Daniel Traster.
Interesting.
Traster also wrote Foundations of Cost Control, which is the central text for the food costs component of the CCC.
Do you know when the books were written?
I have from the library the second edition. So it was originally published in 2014, and the second edition came out in 2018.
That's pretty recent.
Yeah. Both of those texts read fairly contemporary. There's still an odd emphasis or like an unnecessary amount of explanation about computers and point of sale systems.
Oh, right.
Like, I know there are places that still operate without a point of sale, but like not many. Yeah. Like I'm thinking like maybe the barbecue counter at Lucky 97 or something, but like,
yeah.
I don't think I've eaten in a restaurant that doesn't use a point of sale in 20 years. But anyways.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But anyways, so I think the first chapter of the menu planning text, it's called Factors That Define a Menu. But the kind of overall theme is, well, they ask the question, like, what comes first, the menu or the market?
Okay.
And so the real, like, thing they're trying to drive home is that the menu is not a thing unto itself. The menu is a component of the brand and business. And what you should be thinking about the menu as the primary sales tool of the brand. It's how you're going to sell as a restaurant. It's how you're going to sell product to people.
Right.
And on some level, like, I know that and have operated that way. And we've talked about in that recipe development conversation, talked about how like no idea exists in a vacuum. There's all kinds of things you have to consider, the logistical constraints and all that, but having it laid out and explained this way, I started reflecting a lot on the menus that I've written and really tried to ask myself, like, was I really focused on the right thing when I wrote these menus? Like, was my primary goal to integrate into the brand and drive sales? And I think oftentimes it was not my sighed or rolled your eyes.
Sorry. Yeah. And I realized that podcasting is not a visual medium, but I had a really weird look on my face when you were saying that. And I didn't mean to interrupt you with that look.
I think you're scoffing
at the end. Please finish your thought, Alan. And then I have some things to say about it.
you're scoffing at the idea of it, of being obsessed with sales. Is that?
No, I'm not scoffing at that idea.
Oh, okay.
But I do think that, like, let me see if I can formulate this into a cohesive thought, but it's not that I think that the assertion that the menu is the number one component of the sales tools for a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Like, I agree with that. That's real. That just is the way that it is, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like a made up idea to try and, to try and streamline restaurant profits.
Right.
It's just an economic reality, right? Mm-hmm. People come into your restaurant, they're going to look at the menu, and they're going to use the menu to determine what they're going to order or whether they want to order from your restaurant at all, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That's just an economic reality. And I do appreciate that. And I think that it's like worthwhile to consider it in the way that you're saying, like, you know, like you're looking back on previous menus that you're that you've created and you're like, did I do a good job in this way with this menu? Mm-hmm. But like to say that it is the primary thing that you should be thinking about while creating a menu, that's a bridge too far for me. Mm-hmm. Like I understand that, you know, it has to be an important concern. And I understand also that if your goal with your restaurant is to generate profit, that it has to be an important part of the process of menu creation. But I just think that when you're looking at it from the business side, there's a tendency to say things like, you know, this should be your primary concern. But I don't think that that is an economic reality. I think that is just an assertion based on the point of view of the, you know, person who's trying to teach you about the economics of menu development,
right?
You know, mm-hmm. So yeah, that's sort of how I feel about it. There are a lot of primary concerns that you need to have while you're developing a menu, and like the marketing aspect of it as it is associated or like as it relates to the customer is definitely an important part of the things that you need to keep in mind while you're developing a menu, mm-hmm. but it's not the primary concern. There are plenty of concerns that all have equal weight.
Like what?
Like, is the food going to be good? It's a pretty important concern, I feel like.
Well, you know? Yeah, but that's a part of, like, that's part of what we're talking about. Like,
obviously, I understand, is the food going to be good? There are a lot of factors at play there, right? Like, mm-hmm. Can we afford the equipment that we need to make the food that we want to put on this menu that's going to appeal to the customer? Can we have the equipment that we need? Can we train the people to execute it correctly?
Yeah,
you know,
no,
like
exactly
these are
right.
all concerns.
Yeah, and they do they talk about that exactly. But
right.
The starting point is the brand, the business, and a sales tool. And then, of course, like okay. In the same chapter, it goes into logistical constraints and it mentions everything you just said, like the employee skill level, available equipment, availability of products, space, yeah. That kind of thing. So yes, it all needs to be considered. But my takeaway is that like it must be subservient to it must be consistent with the brand and it should be considered a sales tool.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's lots to consider.
Yeah.
And it's funny to just think back on, especially in the age of social media, you think back on menus that were written, dishes, features, and try and parse out in your mind, did I do this to help the brand and business, or did I do it to have something cool on social media? And I know they're kind of the same thing in a way.
Yeah, those things are pretty intertwined.
Well, I think we perceive them to be more intertwined than they actually are. Like when I think about the sheer volume of images of food and descriptions of food that most people see, like people who are interested in food see online, compared to the amount of actual food that they eat and money that they spend mm-hmm. at food service operations, like I think it's really, really out of whack. And just because you get a bunch of likes for a picture and it gets shared or whatever, like it doesn't, it's not proportional necessarily to the amount of people who are actually going to eat it or spend money at your restaurant.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know enough about social media to make a comment on that. I definitely feel like you're right to say that. And you're right to say that we're bombarded with images of food and that, you know, our consumption of like food media in the most, in most cases, in a lot of cases, not just for people who are in the industry or people who are foodies, but like, you know, but for everybody, you know, like pictures of food are all around us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to veer too far off track. You know, like I want to get back to some of the specifics of the course material, but like I think that like social media and the way that marketing is done on social media is sort of like a numbers game.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, and it's kind of disheartening, I think, to creative people who do put time and effort into like putting a post up about their food or about something about their restaurant when, you know, that like post or whatever gets a lot of engagement but doesn't really translate into customers. Mm-hmm. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But then I have been in several situations where for one particular post or for whatever reason that equation just flips, you know, like, and that's the viral aspect of it,
right?
And I think that, like, you know, people who are good at using social media as a communication or like as a sales tool like that understand that most of the posts aren't going to do anything regardless of the quality of the post or the quality of the product that they're selling or whatever. And the one that you don't expect is going to get engagement just like flips and suddenly you're overwhelmed with orders or whatever. And so I don't know, like, I think if you're looking at it from like the effectiveness of a single post, yeah, it doesn't make sense. And, but then the reason I think why we're so bombarded by it is because the people who do understand how that marketing works just understand that they just have to keep flooding it out there and eventually yeah. something will gain traction. And mm-hmm. that's kind of the problem, I think, is that, you know, and that's why we're bombarded with so much marketing on social media that is, you know, that sort of like, it's not really marketing. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. it's a picture of the dinner that I had or whatever. But, you know, like then it eventually, you know, the intention behind it is marketing. And then eventually it has that effect. Mm-hmm. But it just, you know, like it's so pervasive now because you need so much of it in order to like play that numbers game where one of your posts is going to go viral or whatever. And that's one of my biggest problems with social media, I think.
It's exhausting.
Like just in terms of engaging with it personally, right. You know, like yeah. is that there's just so much to sift through. And I feel like it's the same way with like any kind of like media and any kind of content now. It's just like there's so much. You know,
yep.
like
yeah, absolutely.
You can't be exposed to it all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, I don't know, overwhelming for a lot of people, I think. Mm-hmm. And then they just like disengage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Anyway.
But it was nice to, again, thinking back to the recipe development conversation, like it's interesting to me because we have done that a lot, but didn't necessarily have formal training in it. Like
mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's sort of, well, no, it's not really discussed in culinary school. That's much more just like technique and recipe based.
Yeah. I mean, when I was in culinary school in the third year of the apprenticeship program, we did do some menu development and like some.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. You're right. There is a menu planning class. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit, I think not for everyone, but for a lot of students, it's kind of like putting the cart before the horse. Like,
yeah.
If you haven't spent a lot of time in a commercial kitchen, then like talking about the logistical constraints of equipment and staff skill set and stuff like that is a little bit, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around and to understand in a concrete way. So it was interesting to read through this and have it explained in a kind of generalized way, and to see how much of it we did just from our own experience. And also because our experience in Edmonton is the kind of work that we've done is fairly narrow, in that it was like small independent shops. Neither of us have much experience in hotels and convention centers and
or chain restaurants even.
Yeah. And so like the staff skill set is an interesting one. Like I never, when I was writing a menu, I kind of took for granted, or like I understood the types of people who'd be applying for the job, and I never really had to pay particularly close attention to what kind of techniques I would put on the menu. It was kind of a given. But if you want to take a step back and think about the entire breadth of food service, like what if you are, for instance, like you've been tasked with writing a fine dining menu in a remote resort location or something.
Yeah.
And then you would have to take that into consideration, right? Like who lives in the area and what kind of restaurants have they worked at before and stuff like that. So yeah, it's been really interesting in that regard.
Yeah. What do you think are the pieces, like, is there a quick way to run down like what sort of all of the components that they codify in the textbook like are?
Yeah. It's, as you can imagine, it's fairly broad. So the introduction is that, that idea of, the factors that are going to define or influence your menu. So the business brand and the logistical concerns, the stakeholders, like the owners, investors, managers, guests, all that, like taking that into consideration. There's a piece on nutrition, which also is a thing that I almost never thought about in most of my menus. Kind like for some of the daily cafe stuff, like there's definitely people, if you want people to come to the cafe every day, like you want to have lighter and healthier options. But beyond that, it's not something that I had to consider much in my industry experience.
Dietary restrictions is also most of the nutritional decisions that I have made while doing any kind of menu development is because of dietary concerns.
You know? Right. Balanced, like, but just it would be, you're writing a menu, and so you want to make sure there are some items that are gluten-free, some items that are vegetarian. And then,
which I realize isn't specifically nutritional information,
right?
But
dietary. Yeah. And then for the actually writing the menu, the different the kind of high level pricing structures that you can use, so you can have a fully a la carte menu where kind of like a steakhouse, where it's like you order a steak, you get a steak. You want a baked potato, you order a baked potato. You want a salad, you order a salad. And then I didn't really realize this, but most what we think of as a typical restaurant menu in North America is called semi a la carte, apparently, like where the, like you have meat, starch and veg kind of bundled together with its own price,
like a full meal.
Yeah. Compared to like a prefix menu, a tasting menu, that kind of thing. Traditional menu headings that are used, so like obviously you have different menu headings for a breakfast or a brunch place than you would for a dinner service. A lot about the language and how the language, like the descriptive copy on the menu, needs to be consistent with the brand, needs to be clear, needs to be truthful. A lot of this is really obvious, I know, but
yeah,
a really big piece of it is on cost, like menu pricing. So like determining the sales price of the menu items. So part of that is different strategies for like finding food cost, and then how you develop or how you set upon a given sales price.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's some stuff about the layout and the design. And the last important piece of it is called menu engineering, which is basically like you have an established menu and doing a kind of quantitative analysis basically on profitability, like on how to either increase sales or increase the profitability of the menu items.
Right.
Yeah.
So that would be things like, you know, is it more profitable to sell this, to sell fewer of this item at a higher price versus selling more of it at a price that is not quite as profitable or something like that?
It kind of broadly breaks the all of the menu items into four categories. And it's things that you sell a lot that are profitable, things that you sell a lot that are not profitable, things that you don't sell very much of that are profitable, and ones that are. And then trying to tweak that in the direction of higher sales and higher profitability. But
right. As you're going through the list of the concerns or the factors, yeah, as you're going through that list, I do feel like most of the time, well, I have a couple thoughts about it. I feel like, and I don't know if you feel this way, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but I do feel like most of those concerns that are brought up in sort of like that list are things that, yeah, I've never been trained on, but I do have an intuitive sense of their importance when doing menu design.
Right.
But then also that because, you know, I don't have a lot of formal training, I don't necessarily have like a specific approach to each of them or a specific way in which I prioritize them.
Yes.
And and so I wind up relying mostly on my intuition for how to prioritize those things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I do feel like in a lot of cases in terms of menus that I've designed in the past or even, you know, the menu that we have at Kind Ice Cream, which, you know, like I haven't completely designed and it's sort of been designed over time to sort of retroactively fix some of the problems with some of those factors that maybe we didn't see going in or right. something like that, which is probably a lot to do with like, you know, failures in my intuition or potentially the intuition of the business owners or, you know, and then like, and then we've gone back after the fact and tried to sort of like do some retrofits to make some things make more sense, like things that were, you know, that we sold a lot of that weren't very profitable, try to find a way to still make them great and so that we sell a lot of them but make them more profitable.
Right.
Or, you know, get rid of things that, you know, aren't very profitable and we don't sell very yeah. much of and replace them with things that are reasonably profitable that but that sell extremely well or something right. like that. Like I feel like, you know, over the long course of time we've sort of been retrofitting those things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How much does it talk about it, like I feel like laying it out in that way like gives the impression that if you take all of these things into account you can perfectly design a menu and then just roll it out and then you're good to go.
No, but definitely I think yeah. it does a good job the text does a good job of in a way saying like take all this with a grain of salt because you're the one who knows the customer and knows the operation and right. so whatever works but like mm-hmm. kind of like you're saying it gives you a structured way to approach it and make sure that almost like a checklist or like things to consider so yeah, to kind of deferring to you because you know what's going on. And also, yeah, the importance, I mean, that's kind of what the menu engineering is too, is like reflecting on what you've done, what's working and changing the things that could be improved. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's sort of that's the engineering stuff is like after the fact, like being able to look at the effect of what you've done and gather data about it and make changes and things like
that. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's interesting actually. So you asked like, if it's saying that you can perfectly design the menu and then just walk away. And the answer is no. It encourages you to reflect on it and to make changes. However, what's interesting to me is that it does mention repeatedly, like you still have to be true to the brand and changes can be confusing and disruptive to business. Sorry, confusing right. to customers and disruptive to business. And yeah, so that was absolutely. Interesting to me because like, they obviously you're not going to just like torpedo your brand and do something that makes no sense. But even something as simple as like, I think back to a lot of places where it's like we open as a dinner spot and then we're like, oh, I wonder if we should do brunch. And then we yeah. open for brunch, but it wasn't part of the initial plan. And maybe is a bit confusing. Like, not only is it difficult to get the word out and let people know that you're now open for brunch, it also is like, if it wasn't part of your core brand, then it might just be confusing and diluting and stuff like that to the business.
Yeah. Well, and especially if you're like relying on word of mouth from customers for a lot of your promotion, like having things like that where it's difficult for a customer to describe what your restaurant does or what your restaurant is good at, or, you know, like, yeah, I think like simplicity is very helpful if you're relying on word of mouth, you know, for your promotion. And not making changes is important to that simplicity, to like keeping the concept simple in people's minds of like what they can expect when they go there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, it's important to reflect and react. But yeah, I think when I think back to a lot of the projects that we were involved with, like it was almost an element of, let's put it out there and see what works, and then we'll define what, then we'll figure out what we're all about and what the brand is. And so it's an interesting line to draw. Like, it's like, on the one hand, it could be a really great pivot. On the other hand, it could be confusing or detrimental to business. Yeah,
totally. Yeah. And I think that's, I don't know. I mean, I think that, yeah, I think a lot of that sort of like what you're describing, like reactive changes, I do think that like a lot of that comes out of the fact that we are like conceptualizing a restaurant or conceptualizing its menu like intuitively. And a lot of that, like, I don't know, it's tough. It, like, where I kind of get hung up on the idea of codifying menu development is that, in some ways, in a lot of ways, menu development is a creative pursuit, regardless of whether you look at it like primarily from an economic perspective or not. It's still, you still have to, you're still designing something. You're still creating something, right? And as with most creative pursuits, too much structure can make it very difficult to get through that creative process. Like, there needs to be built into that some sort of way for you to just like brainstorm or something, you know, like there needs to be built into it a way for you to not allow the constraints to cause you to not get the creative aspect of it done. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that, like, I haven't read a lot of stuff or seeked out a lot of media specifically about like structured menu development, like what you're talking about. But I have read and listened to a lot of stuff about like the balance between creativity and business. Sort of in my own, in pursuit of my own education in how to, you know, work creatively within the constraints of a business. And so one of the things that like really stands out to me when I start thinking about this, I guess I would call it a dichotomy. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but like, you know, the sort of things that are at odds a little bit when you're trying to structure something that really has to have some sort of like free flowing aspect to it. The like stuff that I come back to the most often is a book called Creativity Inc. It's written by Ed Catmull, I think his name is, and he was the CEO of Pixar for several years. I don't know if he still is. But it's really interesting because it talks a lot about like the early days of Pixar and what they thought it was going to be. And like, you know, in the beginning, it was like just going to be a software company, I think. And, and, you know, and it like turned into this movie studio that is now famous. And for several years was like doing some of the like best creative work in Hollywood, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, the book is kind of about, you know, how do we build a structure that keeps the creativity alive?
Right.
You know, yeah. Like how do we build a structure around allowing creative people to still be creative,
mm-hmm.
but be able to also have an analytical take on whether we're going to be actually making something good or not.
Right.
And it's, yeah, it's fascinating. And I think extremely complicated and difficult. And yeah, I wonder, like, does the book talk about that at all? Or like the text?
I would say no. Okay. Yeah, I can't say that I've come across anything that addresses that. It's much more from a pragmatic,
right,
and from a business minded or economically minded starting point, for sure. I it's weird to bring this up because I haven't read it, but I did come across a book that actually kind of, I think, in a lot of ways is about what you just described with Creativity Inc., only specifically about kitchens.
Oh, that's interesting.
Called The Uncertainty Mindset.
Oh.
And I don't know anything about it, but that's, it just like came up in my reading where it's like, yeah, it's a book that's specifically, I think, about the like boundary pushing restaurants like El Bulli and Noma and all that. And how they tackle the same problem. Although it must not have right. the same kind of business, like those operations rarely have the same business constraints as no. something like
yeah.
Pixar.
Those but, are like really bad examples.
Oh yeah,
honestly.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 But in terms of not so much in bridging the gap between creativity and economics, but like in maintaining creativity, like pushing boundaries right. and continuing to do new things again and again and again. Yeah.
Well, and to be clear, like, I'm not just like it might sound, you know, like it might sound when I say that, you know, like that, like, you know, I'm concerned about like placing a structure around creativity or something like that. I understand that it probably comes off as like, you know, I feel like the creative aspect of menu writing is the important part and you have to protect it or something like that. And I do think that that's true, but I don't think that like, I don't just mean in the like way where, oh, you know, like my food has to be like innovative or bound, you know, like, or pushing boundaries, or it has to be something new and fresh that people haven't experienced before. That's not really what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, those are aspects for certain restaurants that for those restaurants, that's a part of their brand.
Yes.
Like, yeah. you know, and that's what people expect and that's what the menu has to reflect. And,
right.
you know, but like, I am like, like I do mean it from a bit of a more pragmatic point of view where like even just like, you know, the creativity that it takes to like imagine maybe like 50 dishes that you could potentially have on your menu and, you know, and consider what effect those dishes are going to have on, you know, your customer's experience and winnow that down to a selection of things that you think is really going to work, you know, for the customers, for the business. I still think that that is like creative work,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
I feel like, you know, like what worries me is that like having too many checklists and too many things that you have to think about can get in the way of like doing the actual, like, okay, now we know, you know, like, now we have dishes that we can put on a menu,
right?
You know,
yeah.
like that's the creative work that I'm talking about, not necessarily like, you know,
yeah, inventing new stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Inventing yeah. new things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do you feel that way? Like, do you feel like when you're reading that book, you're like, oh man, this is putting a lot of stuff in the way of me being able to intuitively develop a menu? Or are you like, wow, this is a really handy way for me to like, you know, this is put like giving me really good ideas for a really great way that I can walk through this process and it will like sort of propel me through it rather than hold me back?
If it were, so it's not particularly useful for the, like right now I basically have no, I'm not operating a business, right? and so,
well, I mean, you know, that's true, but you also have you have your own set of concerns when it comes to the menu development that you're doing for Earnest, right? Like your like profitability may not be your primary concern, but definitely there's still, you know, the restaurant still has a brand.
That's
the restaurant still has a demographic and a set of customers that you have to please, and you know, and you have additional concerns in that you also have to provide education for the people who are going to be working there.
So I would say that the things in the text that directly apply to the work I do at Earnest's, I was already very much aware of. So things like balancing, like the variety and balance of the menu, varying cooking techniques so that you have like different eating experiences, but also a more evenly distributed workload in the kitchen. That kind of thing in the text, like that's already front and like very front of mind for me. If I were starting a business, I would find this book basically invaluable. Like the way that it talks about brand development and doing the demographic studies and psychographic studies and competitive analyses, feasibility analysis, stuff like that. Like, I think that because we've kind of like, I've flirted with the idea of like opening, like starting food businesses. I guess I have started a food business, but like, I think my mindset 10 years ago would have been like, well, I have this awesome idea. I'm going to do this awesome thing and I'm going to make it awesome, which is good. That's good. Like a good energy to bring to it. But, being pragmatic and really making a good plan for it, is where the value in this text would be, I think. Like,
right.
And especially on the costing side, like we had a way that we did costing at all of the places I've worked, but that's just like one way to do it. And this book gives you so many more techniques, ways to monitor costs and ways to develop menu prices so that you know that you're recouping costs and stuff. So
yeah,
it's, does that answer your question?
I mean, if I can condense your answer into mostly you feel like it's good content that propels you through the process, but that it's
not for writing a menu at Earnest. No.
Right. Yeah.
No. Yeah. That's the straight answer. Yeah.
But if you were starting a business from scratch, that you would want to be aware of the things that are in the textbook.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. You wouldn't necessarily feel like you maybe had to make use of them all.
No.
Or something.
No.
But that, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that answers my question. I think, see, like when I hear you talk about things like, demographic studies and psychographic studies and like those types of things, they seem out of reach, I think, for most people who are planning on starting a food business or opening a restaurant. I mean, I don't know, maybe it gives various, like, you know, maybe it gives like really low level ways that you can just get some very basic information about those things before you make decisions. But like, you know, those are the types of things that, you know, like when you say those words,
yes,
the thing that bubbles up in my head is like, I have to hire a marketing company to do this work for me.
Right.
Right. And like most people who are opening a restaurant do not have money to hire a marketing company to study the community of people that they're planning on opening this restaurant for.
Right.
You know, like most restaurant owners are small business owners, entrepreneurs that probably don't have a ton of funding. And like they, you know, in most cases, they are lucky if they can just secure the money that they need to actually like build out and open the restaurant and purchase the product and the equipment that they're going to need. You know, putting a whole bunch of pre-planning into like demographic studies is probably out of most restaurant entrepreneurs' reach. Mm-hmm. So are there suggestions in the book for how you might go about that if you're not like Earl's?
Well, that's exactly what it makes me think of, is like,
right,
I'm sure we have access to like very high level, whatever, census data and stuff like that. But in terms of like the psychographic study, and that's like for food service operations, that basically means how and where do people spend their money on food? Yeah, that's not.
Well, like, and I think things like census data are basically useless.
Yes.
For like determining whether your customer base is going to be accepting of arrest. You know, like it's not nearly specific enough to give you any kind of actionable information in terms of like making plans for how you're going to market to the people that, you know, that you're trying to market to if you're opening a restaurant.
So what it, yeah. And so what it makes me think of is exactly what you said, like Earl's, like chains like that, that have operated multiple locations and have probably collected their own internal data to use in evaluating where and when to open the next location. And yeah, so I think you're right that those studies that I mentioned, they can be expensive and not within reach for most people. But I think it is more like thinking about that, like considering it when you're developing a brand and choosing a location and stuff like that. Just taking the time to think about it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, which I don't know, maybe is like slightly better than just like, just not really thinking about it and just going off your intuition, you know, like if you take time out to be like, okay, who do I actually think my customers are going to be, you know, like,
right. Yeah. So that you can, yeah, build that into all of the planning. And if you're going in with, I feel like I'm defending this book, even though I'm trying to sell it to people or something, but, the mindset being not just, I've got a great food idea and I'm going to put it out and it's going to be awesome. It's like, who's going to buy it? Who's going to eat it? Who's going to be coming there? How are they going to get there? How much do they want to spend? Like, what are their expectations? Like a much more kind of market-oriented or customer-oriented way of thinking about it, or at least considering that, instead of just like, as a chef, you know, just thinking about food and how it's going to taste and all that. That's Foundations of Menu Planning, second edition by Daniel Traster. I feel like I was just like, oh, I've been reading this book and it's kind of interesting. And you're like, what? Have you like drank the Kool-Aid or something? Like, I don't know.
I guess you feel like the content of the book is helpful. Do you, I guess like what I'm wondering is like we've done it on the show, like looked at the task of menu planning and tried to sort of like break it down into what the considerations are and what the variables are and how we tend to like try to intuitively manage those things when we're making a menu plan. Mm-hmm. And then this book, provides some kind of like a similar breakdown, but obviously, you know, probably broken down a lot farther and then like, you know, in a lot more detailed way. I like, is there, do you think like after reading some of what's in this textbook, like, do you think that there is a sort of like one true approach, you know, like, can you actually codify the process of menu development? Or is it the type of thing where, you know, someone else could write another book codifying the process of menu development and it might be completely different, but still entirely valid? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
I think so.
Like, is there a core kind of like truth to the process of menu development that, like, you know, regardless of whether you're following your intuition or not, all of these things that are in the book are just like true factors? Or do you feel like, you know, it's just sort of like one person's kind of, I don't want to say opinion, but one person's like representation of a structured way that you can approach it?
Well, I think, again, it does a good job for everything that it says. It will give an exception.
Right.
So like take a really simple principle, like the idea that you should have a variety of ingredients. So for instance, like if the menus say at Ernest that we've talked about, like most of the entrees are centered around a protein. And so we know we're not going to have four chicken proteins as entrees on Ernest. So it talks about, yeah, the idea of variety and balance. You probably want a beef dish and a chicken dish and a pork dish, whatever. But then it will give you a exception. It's like, well, but if you have a yakitori restaurant, then obviously you're going to have multiple chicken dishes. If you have a fried chicken joint, right, obviously you're going to have loads of chicken on the menu. And so it does a good job of deferring to you and empowering you to make the call. But again, it's right. all... It all depends on the project, on the brand, and what you're trying to do. So, yeah, in that way, like it's not saying that it's a, you know, this is the way to do it and this is the only way to do right. it. And it kind of encourages you to be mindful and reflective on, yeah, what the project is, what its goals are, and what you need to do to accomplish it.
It's interesting. I think I'd like to read this book, Alan.
You'd like to read Foundations of Menu Planning by Daniel Traster?
Oh, man, you are selling it.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.